The hallway was of the deepest black. She'd almost forgotten how dark the stone walls of the palace were. The hallway was empty, save for Bluefingers, who stood waiting for her with his ledger.
The God King will be pleased, Vessel. We are exactly on time. The sun only just set.
Ciri turned from Bluefingers. Directly across from her was a large, imposing door. It was plated entirely with gold. Four wall lamps shone without colored glass, and they reflected light off the gilded portal. She had no question as to who lay beyond such an impressive entrance.
This is the God King's sleeping chambers. Rather, one of his sleeping chambers. Now, my lady, you must hear this again. Do nothing to offend the king. You are here at his sufferance, and you are here to see to his needs. Not mine, not your own, and not even that of the kingdom.
I understand.
Thank you. It is time to present yourself. Enter the room, then remove your dress and underclothing. Bow yourself to the ground before the king's bed, touching your head to the floor. When he wishes for you to approach, he will knock on the side post, and you may look up. He will then wave you forward.
Ciri nodded.
Just try not to touch him too much.
How exactly am I going to manage that? We're going to have sex, aren't we?
Yes. Yes, I guess you are. This is new ground for me too, my lady. The God King... Well, only a group of specially dedicated servants are supposed to touch him. My suggestion would be to avoid kissing him, caressing him, or doing anything else that might offend him. Simply let him do to you what he wishes, and you should be safe. When you are finished, the king will withdraw. Take the bed linens and burn them in the hearth. As the vessel, you are the only one allowed to handle such things. Do you understand?
Yes.
Very well, then. Good luck.
With that, Bluefingers reached forward and pushed the door open.
Oh, Ostri, god of colors.
Bluefingers pushed her lightly on the back, and she stepped into the room. A large fire glowed in a hearth to her left, bringing a shifting orange light to the large room. The black walls seemed to draw in and absorb the illumination, making deep shadows at the edges of the room. Ciri stood quietly in her ornate velvet dress, heart thumping, brow sweating. To her right, she could make out a massive bed with sheets and covers of black to match the rest of the room. The bed appeared unoccupied. Ciri peered into the darkness, eyes adjusting. The fire threw a flicker of light across a large throne-like chair sitting beside the bed. It was occupied by a figure wearing black, bathed in darkness. He watched her, eyes twinkling, unblinking in the firelight. Ciri cast her eyes downward.
Vivena should be here instead of me. I can't deal with this. Father was wrong to send me.
Ciri squeezed her eyes shut. She worked shaking fingers and pulled nervously at the strings on the side of her dress. Her hands were slick with sweat. Was she taking too long to undress? Would he be angered? Would she be killed before even the first night was out? Would she, perhaps, prefer that?
No. No, I need to do this. For Idris. For the fields and the children who took flowers from me. For my father, and Mab, and everyone else in the palace.
Ciri finally got the strings undone, and the gown fell away with surprising ease. She could now see that it had been constructed with that goal in mind. She dropped the dress to the floor, then paused, looking at her undershift. The white fabric was throwing out a spectrum of colors, like light bent by a prism.
Oh!
She regarded this with shock, wondering what was causing the strange effect. It didn't matter. She was too nervous to think about that. Gritting her teeth, she forced herself to pull off her undershift, leaving her naked. She quickly knelt on the cold stone floor, curling up, as she bowed with her forehead touching the floor. Ciri waited, hair pure white, arrogance and stubbornness discarded, naked in more than one way. This is where she ended up. This is where all her independent sense of freedom came to an end. No No matter what she claimed or how she felt, in the end, she had to bow to authority, just like anyone else. She gritted her teeth, imagining the God King sitting there, watching her be subservient and naked before him. She hadn't seen much of him, other than to notice his size. He was a good foot taller than most other men she'd seen, and was wider of shoulders and more powerful of build as well. More significant than other, lesser men, he was returned. In and of itself, being returned wasn't a sin. After all, returned came in Idris, too. The Halandran people, however, kept the returned alive, feeding them on the souls of peasants, tearing away the breath of hundreds of people each year.
Don't think of that.
Yet, as she tried to clear her thoughts, the God King's eyes returned to her memory. Those black eyes, which had seemed to glow in the firelight. She could feel them on her still, watching her, as cold as the stones upon which she knelt. Blue Fingers had said that the king would knock for her. What if she missed it? She didn't dare glance upward. She'd already met his gaze once, if by accident. She couldn't risk upsetting him further. She just continued to kneel in place, elbows on the ground, back beginning to ache.
Why doesn't he do something?
Was he displeased with her? Was she not as pretty as he desired? Or was he angered that she'd met his eyes, then taken too long to undress? Or was something else wrong? He had been promised the eldest daughter of the Idrian king, but had instead received Ciri. Would he know the difference? Would he even care? The minutes passed, the room growing darker as the fire consumed its logs.
He's toying with me, forcing me to wait on his whims.
Making her kneel in such an uncomfortable position was probably a message, one that showed who was in power. He would take her when he willed it, and not before. Ciri gritted her teeth as the time passed. How long had she been kneeling? An hour, maybe longer. And still, there wasn't a hint of sound. No knock, no cough, not even a shuffle from the God King. Perhaps it was a test to see how long she would remain as she was. Perhaps she was just reading too much into things. Either way, she forced herself to remain in place, shifting only when she absolutely had to. Vivenna had the training. Vivenna had the poise and the refinement. But Ciri, she had the stubbornness. One only had to look back at her history of repeatedly ignoring lessons and duties to appreciate that. With time, she'd even broken down her father. He'd started letting her do as she pleased, if only to save his own sanity. And so, she continued to wait, naked in the light of the coals, as the night wore on. Fireworks sprayed sparks up in a fountain of light. Some fell close to where Light Song was sitting, and these blazed with an extra frenzied light until they died away. He reclined on a couch in the open air, watching the display. Servants waited around him, complete with parasols, a portable bar, steaming and chilled towels to rub his face and hands should he feel the need, and a host of other luxuries that, to Light Song, were simply commonplace. He watched the fireworks with mild interest. The firemaster stood in a nervous cluster near his position. Beside them were a troop of minstrels that Light Song had called for, but hadn't yet asked to perform. While there were always entertainers in the court of gods for the return to enjoy, this night, the wedding night of their god king, was even more extravagant in that regard. Suzebron wasn't in attendance himself, of course. Such festivities were beneath him. Light Song glanced to the side, where the king's palace rose soberly above the court. Eventually, Light Song just shook his head and turned his attention back to the courtyard. The palaces of the gods formed a ring, and each building had a patio below and a balcony above, both facing the central area. Light Song sat a short distance from his patio, out amidst the lush grass of the expansive courtyard. Light Song accepted another fruit drink from a servant. The night was cool and pleasant, fit for a god or gods. Light Song could see others set up in front of their palaces. Different groups of performers cluttered the sides of the courtyard, waiting for their chance to please one of the returned. The firemasters looked toward him, smiling hopefully in the torchlight. Lightsong nodded with his best benevolent expression.
More fireworks. You have pleased me.
As they set up, a familiar figure wandered into Lightsong's ring of torches. Larimar wore his priestly robes, as always. Even when he was out in the city, which was where he should have been this night, he represented Lightsong and his priesthood.
Scoot.
Your Grace, are you enjoying the festivities?
Certainly. You might say I'm positively infested with them. But what are you doing here in the court? You should be out with your family.
I just wanted to make certain everything was to your liking.
You're giving me a headache, Scoot.
You can't get headaches, Your Grace.
So you're fond of telling me. I assume the revelry outside the holy prison is nearly as amazing as what we have here inside.
Larimar frowned at Lightsong's dismissive reference to the divine compound, but responded without any reproof.
The party in the city is fantastic, Your Grace. Hetalir hasn't seen a festival this grand in decades.
Then I repeat that you should be out enjoying it.
I just...
Scoot! If there's one thing you can trust me to do competently on my own, it's enjoy myself. I will, I promise in all solemnity, have a ravishingly good time drinking to excess and watching these nice men light things on fire. Now go, be with your family.
Larimar paused, then stood, bowed, and withdrew.
That man takes his work far too seriously.
The concept amused Lightsong, and he leaned back, enjoying the fireworks. However, he was soon distracted by the approach of someone else. Or, rather, one very important someone else leading a group of far less important someone else's. The newcomer was beautiful. She was a goddess, after all. Glossy black hair, pale skin, lushly curvaceous body. She wore far less clothing than Lightsong did, but that was typical of the court's goddesses. Her thin gown of green and silver silk was split on both sides, showing hips and thighs, and the neckline was draped so low that very little was left to imagination. Blushweaver the Beautiful, goddess of honesty.
This should be interesting.
Blushweaver was trailed by about 30 servants, not to mention her high priest and 6 lesser priests. A group of Blushweaver's servants rushed forward, carrying an ornate couch, which they set on the grass beside Lightsong. Blushweaver lay down with customary lithe grace, crossing perfect legs and resting on her side in a seductive yet ladylike pose. The orientation left her able to watch the fireworks, should she wish, but her attention was obviously focused on Lightsong.
My dear Lightsong, aren't you even going to greet me?
Here we go. My dear Blushweaver, why would I go and do something rude like that?
Rude?
Of course. You obviously make quite a determined effort to draw attention to yourself. The details are magnificent, by the way. Is that makeup on your thighs?
It's a kind of paint. The designs were drawn by some of the most talented artists in my priesthood.
My compliments to them. Regardless, you ask why I did not greet you. Well, let us assume that I had acted as you suggest I should. Upon your approach, you would have had me gush over you?
Naturally.
You would have me point out how stunning you appear in that gown?
I wouldn't complain.
Mention how your dazzling eyes glisten in the fireworks like burning embers?
That would be nice.
Expound on how your lips are so perfectly red that they could dumbfound any man, yet drive him to compose the most brilliant of poetry each time he recalled the moment.
I'd be flattered for certain.
And you claim you want these reactions from me?
I do.
Well, blast it, woman. If I'm stunned, dazzled, and dumbfounded, then how the hell am I supposed to greet you? By definition, won't I be expected to remain in silence?
Well then, you've obviously found your tongue now.
Surprisingly, it was in my mouth. I always forget to check there.
But isn't that where it's expected to be?
My dear, haven't you known me long enough to realize that my tongue, of all things, rarely does what it's expected to do?
So, you do find me beautiful?
Of course. Why, my dear, you're positively rank with beauty. You're literally part of the definition of the word. It's in your title somewhere, if I'm not mistaken.
My dear Lightsong, I do believe you're making sport of me.
I never make fun of ladies, Blushweaver. Mocking a woman is like drinking too much wine. It may be fun for a short time, but the hangover is hell.
But we don't get hangovers, for we cannot get drunk.
We can't? Then why the blazes am I drinking all of this wine?
Sometimes, Lightsong, I'm not certain when you are being silly and when you're being serious.
Well, I can help you with that one easily enough. If you ever conclude that I'm being serious, then you can be sure that you've been working too hard on the problem.
I see.
Blushweaver twisted on her couch so that she was face down. She leaned on her elbows with breasts pushed up between them, fireworks lighting her exposed back.
So then, you admit that I'm stunning and beautiful. Would you then care to retire from the festivities this evening? Find other entertainments?
White Song hesitated. Being unable to bear children didn't stop the gods from seeking intimacy, particularly with other returned. In fact, from what Light Song could guess, the impossibility of offspring only increased the laxness of the court in these matters. Many a god took mortal lovers. Blushweaver was known to have a few of her own among her priests. Dalliances with mortals were never seen as infidelity among the gods. Blushweaver lounged on her couch, supple, inviting. Light Song opened his mouth, but in his mind he saw her, the woman of his vision, the one from his dreams. The face he'd mentioned to Laramon. Who was she? Probably nothing. A flash from his former life. Or perhaps simply an image crafted by his subconscious. Maybe even, as the priests claimed, some kind of prophetic symbol. That face shouldn't give him pause. Not when confronted with perfection.
I must decline. I need to watch the fireworks.
Are they that much more fascinating than I?
Not at all. They simply seem far less likely to burn me.
Well, why don't we wait until they're through, then retire?
Alas, I still must decline. I am far too lazy.
Too lazy for sex?
I'm really quite indolent. A poor example of a god, as I keep telling my high priest. Nobody seems to listen to me, so I fear that I must continue to be diligent in proving my point. Dallying with you would, unfortunately, undermine the entire basis of my argument.
You confuse me sometimes, Light Song. If it weren't for your reputation, I'd simply presume you to be shy. How could you have slept with Calmseer, but consistently ignore me?
Calmseer was the last honorable return this city has known. Nobody left has a shred of her decency, myself included.
Blushweaver fell silent, watching the latest display from the Firemasters. Blushweaver didn't make any move to return to her own palace grounds, and Lightsong said nothing further. He suspected that she hadn't come simply for verbal sparring, or even to try and bed him. Blushweaver always had her plans. In Lightsong's experience, there was more depth to the woman than her gaudy surface suggested. Eventually, his hunch paid off. She turned from the fireworks, eyeing the dark palace of the God King.
We have a new queen.
I noticed. Though admittedly, only because I was reminded several times.
Have you no thoughts on the matter?
I try to avoid having thoughts. They lead to other thoughts, and if you're not careful, those lead to actions. Actions make you tired. I have this on rather good authority from someone who once read it in a book.
Oh, you avoid thinking. You avoid me. You avoid effort. Is there anything you don't avoid?
Breakfast.
Blushweaver didn't react to this, which Lightsong found disappointing. She was too focused on the king's palace. Lightsong usually tried to ignore the large black building. He didn't like how it seemed to loom over him.
Perhaps you should make an exception and give some thought to this particular situation. This queen means something.
Lightsong turned his cup around in his fingers. He knew that Blushweaver's priests were among those who called most strongly for war in the court assembly. He hadn't forgotten his phantom nightmare from earlier, the vision of Taitelaire on fire. That image refused to fade from his mind. He never said anything for or against the idea of war. He just didn't want to be involved.
We've had queens before.
Never one of the royal line. At least there hasn't been one since the days of Kalad the Usurper.
Kalad, the man who had started the Many War, the one who had used his knowledge of biochromatic breath to create a vast army of lifeless and seize power in Helandrin. He had protected the kingdom with his armies, yet had shattered the kingdom as well by driving the royals into the highlands. Now they were back, or at least, one of them was.
This is a dangerous day, Light Song. What happens if that woman bears a child who isn't returned?
Impossible.
Oh, you are that confident?
Of the returned, only the God King can engender children, and they're always stillborn.
The only word we have for that is from the palace priests themselves. Yet I've heard of discrepancies in the records? Even if we don't worry about those, there are plenty of other considerations. Why do we need a royal to legitimize our throne? Isn't 300 years of rule by the court of gods sufficient to make the kingdom legitimate?
Lightsong didn't respond.
This marriage implies that we still accept royal authority. What happens if that king up in the highlands decides to take his lands back? What happens if that queen of ours has a child by another man? Who is the heir? Who rules?
The God King rules. Everyone knows that.
He didn't rule 300 years ago. The royals did. Then, after them, Kalad did. And after him, Peacegiver. Change can happen quickly. By inviting that woman into our city, we may have initiated the end of the returned rule in Helandrin.
Blushweaver fell silent, pensive. Lightsong studied the beautiful goddess. It had been 15 years since her return, which made her old for a return. Old, wise, and incredibly crafty.
I don't intend to find myself caught, surprised, like the royals were when Kalad seized their throne. Some of us are planning, Lightsong. You can join us, if you wish.
Politics, my dear. You know how I loathe it.
You're the god of bravery. We could use your confidence.
At this point, I'm only confident that I'll be of no use to you.
Blushweaver's face stiffened, and she tried not to show her frustration. Eventually, she stood, stretching, showing off her perfect figure once more.
You'll have to stand for something eventually, Lightsong. You're a god to these people.
Not by choice, my dear.
Blushweaver smiled and bent down and kissed him softly.
Just consider what I said. You're a better man than you give yourself credit for being. You think I'd offer myself to just anyone?
Actually, yes, I do.
Oh, come now. There must be at least three of the other gods I wouldn't think of letting touch me. Enjoy the party. And do try to imagine what our king is doing to our legacy up there in his chambers right now. Particularly if that imagining reminds you of what you just missed out on.
Blushweaver winked, then glided away. Lightsong sat back on his couch, the fireworks display having ended. He tried to empty his mind of both Blushweaver's ominous words and the visions of war that had plagued his dreams. He failed on both counts. Ciri rolled over. Her back hurt, her arms hurt, and her head hurt. In fact, she was so uncomfortable that she couldn't stay asleep, despite her fatigue. She sat up, holding her head. She'd spent the night on the floor of the God King's bedchamber, sleeping, kind of. Sunlight poured into the room, reflecting off the marble where the floor wasn't covered with rugs.
Ugh, black rugs on a black floor with black furniture. These Helandrins certainly know how to run with a motif.
The God King wasn't in the room. Ciri glanced toward the oversized black leather chair where he'd spent much of the night. She hadn't seen him leave. Ciri rose, pulling her shift out of the wadded mound of dress and putting it on over her head. She pulled her hair out, flipping it behind her. Keeping it so long was going to take some time getting used to. It fell down against her back, a contented blonde in color. She'd somehow survived the night untouched. She walked on bare feet over to the leather chair, running her fingers along its smooth surface. She'd been less than respectful. She'd dozed off. She'd curled up and pulled her dress close. She'd even glanced over at the chair a few times. Not because of defiance or a disobedient heart. She'd simply been too drowsy to remember that she wasn't supposed to look at the God King. And he hadn't ordered her executed. Blue Fingers had made her worry that the God King was volatile and quick to anger. Yet if that were the case, then he had held his temper with her. What else was he going to do? The Helandrin had waited for decades to get a royal princess to marry into their line of God Kings.
They do have some power.
The God King couldn't kill her, not until he had what he wanted. It wasn't much, but it did give her a bit more confidence. She walked around the chair, noting its size. Everything in the room was built to be just a little too large, skewing her perspective, making her feel shorter than she was. She rested her hand on the arm of the chair and found herself wondering why he hadn't decided to take her. What was wrong with her? Wasn't she desirable?
Foolish girl.
You spent most of the trip here worrying about what would happen on your wedding night. And when nothing happens, you complain about that too.
She knew she wasn't free. He would take her, eventually. That was the point of the entire arrangement. But it hadn't happened last night. She climbed up into the bed and curled up under the covers, drifting off. The next time she woke was a great deal more pleasant than the previous one had been. She noticed something. Her dress, which she'd left sitting in a heap on the floor, was gone. Also, the fire in the hearth had been rebuilt, though why that was necessary was beyond her. The day was warm, and she'd kicked off the covers as she'd slept.
I'm supposed to burn the sheets. That's the reason they stoked the fire.
Ciri sat up in her shift, alone in the black room. The servants and priests wouldn't know that she'd spent the entire night on the floor unless the God King had told someone. Yet, how likely would it be for a man of his power to speak with his priests about intimate details? Slowly, Ciri climbed out of bed and pulled the sheets free. She wadded them up, walked over, and threw them into the large hearth. Still, she didn't know why the God King had left her alone. Until she knew, it was surely better to just let everyone assume that the marriage had been consummated. After the sheets were done burning, Ciri scanned the room, looking for something to wear. She found nothing. She walked to the door, clothed only in her shift. She pulled it open.
Oh!
2 dozen serving women of varying ages knelt outside.
God of colors! How long have they been kneeling out here?
Suddenly, Ciri didn't feel quite so indignant at being forced to wait upon the God King's whims. The women stood up, heads bowed, and walked into the room. Ciri backed up. Cocking her head, she noticed that several of the women carried in large chests.
They're dressed in different colors from the day before.
The cut was the same, divided skirts like flowing trousers, topped with sleeveless blouses and small caps, their hair coming out of the back. Instead of the blue and silver, the outfits were now yellow and copper. The women opened the trunks, removing various layers of clothing. All were of bright colors, and each was of a different cut. The women spread them out on the floor before Ciri, then settled back on their knees, waiting. Ciri hesitated. She'd grown up the daughter of a king, so she'd never really lacked. Yet, life in Idris was austere. She'd owned 5 dresses, which had nearly been an extravagant number. 1 had been white, and the other 4 had been the same wan blue. Being confronted by so many colors and options felt overwhelming. She tried to imagine how each would look on her. Many of them were dangerously low-cut, even more so than the shirts the serving women wore, and those were already scandalous by Idris standards. Finally, hesitantly, Ciri pointed at one outfit. It was a dress in 2 pieces, red skirt and matching blouse. As Ciri pointed, the serving women stood, some putting away the unchosen outfits, others walking over to carefully remove Ciri's shift. In a few minutes, Ciri was dressed. She was embarrassed to find that, while the clothing fit her perfectly, the blouse was designed to reveal her midriff. Still, it wasn't as low cut as the others, and the skirt went all the way down to her calves. The silky red material was far brighter than the thick wools and linen she was accustomed to wearing. The skirt flared and ruffled when she turned, and Ciri couldn't be completely certain it wasn't sheer. Standing in it, she almost felt as naked as she'd been during the night.
That appears to be a recurring theme for me here.
The serving women backed away. Others approached with a stool, and she sat, waiting as the women cleaned her face and arms with a pleasantly warm cloth. When that was done, they reapplied her makeup, did her hair, then sprayed her with a few puffs of perfume. When she opened her eyes, perfume misting down around her, Bluefingers was standing in the room.
Ah, excellent. You're up already.
Already? It has to be well past noon.
Bluefingers looked her over, nodded to himself, then glanced at the bed, obviously checking to see that the linens had been destroyed.
Well, I trust that your servants will see to your needs, Vessel.
Wait!
Vessel?
Do you know what I'm supposed to do?
Do, Vessel? You mean in regards to...
Bluefingers glanced at the bed.
No, not that. I mean with my time. What are my duties? What is expected of me?
To provide an heir.
Beyond that?
Well, To be honest, Vessel, I really don't know. I must say your arrival has certainly caused a level of disruption in the Court of Gods.
In my life, too.
Not that you're to blame, of course. But then, well, I certainly wish I'd had more forewarning.
More forewarning? This marriage was arranged by treaty over 20 years ago.
Yes, well, but nobody thought... Well, either way, we shall do our best to accommodate you here in the King's Palace.
What was that? Nobody thought that the marriage would really happen? Why not? Did they assume that Idris wouldn't keep its part of the bargain? Yes, but what am I supposed to do? Am I to sit here in the palace and stare at the fire all day?
Oh, colors, no. M'lady, this is the Court of the Gods. You'll find plenty to occupy you. Each day, performers are allowed to enter the court and display their talents for their deities. You may have any of these brought to you for a private performance.
Ah, can I maybe go horseback riding?
I suppose we could bring some horses into the court for you. Of course, we'll have to wait until the wedding jubilations are over.
Wedding jubilations?
You don't know, then? Were you not prepared for any of this?
Ciri flushed.
No offense intended, Vessel. The wedding jubilation is a week-long period in which we celebrate the God-King's marriage. During that time, you are not to leave this palace. At the end of it, you will officially be presented to the Court of Gods.
Oh, and after that, I can go out into the city?
Out of the city? Vessel, you can't leave the Court of Gods.
What?
You may not be a god yourself, but you're the wife of the God King. It would be far too dangerous to let you out. But do not fret. Anything and everything you might request can be provided for you.
Except freedom.
I assure you, once the wedding jubilation is over, you will find little to complain about. Everything you could want is here. Every type of indulgence, every luxury, every diversion.
Ciri nodded numbly, still feeling trapped.
Also, if you wish, the court assembly meets to provide decisions to the people. Full assembly meets once a week, though daily there are smaller judgments to be made. You aren't to sit in the assembly itself, of course, but you will certainly be allowed to attend once the jubilation is over. If none of this suits you, you may request an artist of the God King's priesthood to attend you. His priests include devout and accomplished artists from all genres. Music, painting, dance, poetry, sculpture, puppetry, play performance, sand painting, or any of the lesser genres.
God of colors! Even being idle is daunting here. But there isn't any of this that I'm required to attend.
No, I shouldn't think so. Vessel, you look displeased.
I...
How could she explain? Her entire life, she'd been expected to be something. And for most of her life, she'd intentionally avoided being it. Now that was gone from her. She couldn't disobey lest she get herself killed and get Idris into a war. For once, she was willing to serve, to try and be obedient. But, ironically, there didn't seem to be anything for her to do. Except, of course, bear a child.
Very well. Where are my rooms? I'll go there and situate myself.
Your rooms, Vessel?
Yes. I assume I'm not to reside in this chamber itself.
No, the conception room. Of course not.
Then where?
Oh, Vessel, in a way, this entire palace is yours. I don't see why you'd need specific rooms. Ask to eat, and your servants will set up a table. If you wish to rest, they will bring you a couch or a chair. Seek entertainment, and they will fetch performers for you.
Suddenly, the strange actions of her servants, simply bringing her an array of colors to choose from, then doing her makeup and hair right there, made more sense.
I see. And the soldiers I brought with me, did they do as I commanded?
Yes, Vessel, they left this morning. It was a wise decision. They are not dedicated servants of the Tones, and would not have been allowed to remain here in the court. They could do you no further service.
Ciri nodded.
Vessel, if I might be excused...
Ciri nodded distractedly, and Bluefingers bustled away, leaving her to think about how terribly alone she was.
Can't focus on that.
Instead, she turned to one of her serving women, a younger one, about Ciri's own age.
Well, that really doesn't tell me what to spend my time on, does it?
The servant blushed quietly, bowing her head.
I mean, there seems to be a lot to do. Maybe too much.
The girl bowed again.
That is going to get very annoying very quickly.
Part of her wanted to do something shocking to get a reaction out of the servant, but she knew she was just being foolish. In fact, it seemed that many of her natural impulses and reactions wouldn't work here in Halandrin. So, to keep herself from doing something silly, Ciri stood up, determined to examine her new home. She left the overly black room, poking her head out into the hallway. She turned back to her servants, who stood obediently in a line behind her.
Is there any place I'm forbidden to go?
The one she was addressing shook her head. Ciri crossed the hallway, opened the door, then stepped into the yellow room she'd been in the day before. The chair and bench she'd used had been removed, replaced by a group of yellow couches. Ciri raised an eyebrow, then walked through into the tub room beyond. The tub was gone.
Oh!
The room was the one she remembered, the same red colorings. Yet the sloped tile platforms with their inset tubs were gone. The entire contraption must have been portable, brought in for her bath, then removed.
They really can transform any room. They must have chambers full of furniture, tubs and drapings, all of a different color, waiting upon the whims of their god.
Curious, she left the tub-less room and moved in a random direction. Each room appeared to have four doors, one on each wall. Some rooms were larger than others. Some had windows to the outside, while others were locked in the middle of the palace. Each was a different color, yet it was still difficult to tell the difference between them. Endless rooms, pristine with their decorations, following a single color's theme. Soon, she was hopelessly lost, but it didn't seem to matter. Every room was, in a way, the same as any other. She turned to her servants.
I would like breakfast.
It happened far faster than Ciri would have thought possible. Several of the women ducked out and returned with a stuffed green chair to match her current room. Ciri sat down, waiting as a table, chairs, and finally food were produced as if out of nowhere. In less than 15 minutes, she had a hot meal waiting for her. Hesitantly, she picked up a fork and tried a bite. It wasn't until that moment that she realized how hungry she was. The meal was composed primarily of a group of sausages mixed with vegetables. The flavors were far stronger than she was accustomed to. However, the more she ate the spicy Halandrin food, the more she found herself liking it. Hungry or not, it was strange to eat in silence. Ciri was accustomed to either eating in the kitchens with the servants or at the table with her father, his generals, and whatever local people or monks he had invited to his home that evening. It was never a silent affair. Yet here in Halandrin, land of colors, sounds, and ostentation, she found herself eating alone, quietly, in a room that felt dull despite its bright decorations. Her servants watched. None of them spoke to her. Their silence was supposed to be respectful, she knew, but Ciri just found it intimidating.
Is this what my life is to be from now on? Nights spent feeling half used, half ignored by my husband, then days spent surrounded by people, yet somehow still alone.
Ciri set down the fork, and her food slowly grew cold on the table before her. She stared at it, a part of her wishing she'd simply remained in the comfortable, oversized black bed. The Venna, firstborn child of Dedalin, king of Idris, gazed upon the grand city of Tae Talir. It was the ugliest place she had ever seen. People jostled their way through the streets, draped flagrantly in colors, yelling and talking and moving and stinking and coughing and bumping. Her hair lightened to gray, and she pulled her shawl close as she maintained her imitation, such that it was, of an elderly woman. She had feared that she might stand out. She needn't have worried. Who could ever stand out in this confusion? Nevertheless, she continued the disguise. It was best to be safe. She had come, arriving in Tae Talir just hours ago, to rescue her sister, not to get herself kidnapped. It was a bold plan. The Venna could hardly believe that she'd come up with it. Still, of the many things her tutors had taught her, one was foremost in her mind. A leader was someone who acted. Nobody else was going to help Ciri, and so it was up to Vivenna. She knew that she was inexperienced. She hoped that her awareness of that would keep her from being too foolhardy. But she had the best education and political tutelage her kingdom could provide, and much of her training had focused on life in Halandrin. As a devout daughter of Austri, she'd practiced all of her life to avoid standing out. She could hide in a vast, disorganized city like Tae Talir. And vast it was. She'd memorized maps, but they hadn't prepared her for the sight, sound, scent, and colors of the city on market day. Even the livestock wore bright ribbons. Vivenna stood at the side of the road, stooped beside a building draped in flapping streamers. In front of her, a herdsman drove a small flock of sheep toward the market square. They had each been dyed a different color. The different colors on the animals clashed so terribly that she had to look away.
Poor Ciri. Caught up in all of this. Locked in the court of gods. Probably so overwhelmed that she can barely think.
Vivenna had been trained to deal with the terrors of Halandrin. Though the colors sickened her, she had the fortitude to withstand them. How would little Ciri manage? Vivenna tapped her foot as she stood beside the building in the shadow of a large stone statue.
Where is that man?
Parlin had yet to return from his scouting. There was nothing to do but wait. She glanced up at the statue beside her. It was one of the famous Daedalus Celebrant, which had been commissioned by Peacegiver the Blessed to commemorate the end of the Many War. Most of the statues depicted warriors. They stood in every imaginable pose all across the entire city, armed with weapons and often dressed in colorful clothing. According to her lessons, the people of Tetelair found dressing the statues to be an amusing pastime. Lore had it that the first ones had been commissioned by Peacegiver the Blessed, the returned who had taken command of the Halandrin at the end of the Many War. The number of statues had increased each year as new ones were paid for by the returned, whose money, of course, came from the people themselves.
Excess and waste.
Finally, she noticed Parlin coming back down the street. She frowned as she saw that he was wearing some ridiculous frippery on his head. It looked a little like a sock, though much larger. The bright green hat flopped down one side of his square face and looked very out of place against his dull brown Idris travel clothing. Tall, but not lanky, Parlin was only a few years Vivenna's senior. She'd known him for most of her life. General Yarda's son had practically grown up in the palace. More recently, he'd been out in the forests, watching the Halandrin border or guarding one of the northern pastures.
Parlin, what is that on your head?
A hat?
I can see that it's a hat, Parlin. Where did you get it?
The man in the market said they're very popular.
Vivenna had hesitated to bring Parlin into the city. He was a good man, as solid and reliable as she'd ever known. But the life he knew was one of living in the wilderness and guarding isolated outposts. The city was probably overwhelming to him.
The hat is ridiculous, Parlin, and it makes you stand out.
Parlin removed the hat, tucking it in his pocket. He said nothing further, but did turn, watching the crowds of people pass. They seemed to make him as nervous as they did Vivenna, perhaps more so. However, she was glad to have him. He was one of the few people she trusted not to go to her father. She knew that Parlin fancied her. During their youth, he'd often brought her gifts from the forest. Usually, those had taken the form of some animal he'd killed. To Parlin's mind, nothing showed affection like a hunk of something dead and bleeding on the table.
This place is strange. People here move like herds.
Parlin's eyes followed a pretty Halandrin girl as she walked by. The hussy was, like most of the women in Tetelair, wearing practically nothing. Blouses that were open well below the neck, skirts well above the knees. Some women even wore trousers just like men.
What did you discover in the market?
There are a lot of Idrians here.
What?
Idrians, in the market. Some are trading goods. Many look like common labourers. I watched them.
And the restaurant? Did you scout it as I asked?
Looks clean. Feels strange to me that people eat food made by strangers.
Did you see anyone suspicious there?
What would be suspicious in this city?
I don't know. You're the one who insisted on scouting ahead.
It's always a good idea when hunting. Less likely to scare away the animals.
Unfortunately, Parlin, people aren't like animals.
I am aware of that. Animals make sense.
Vivenna did notice just then that Parlin had been right on at least one count. She caught sight of a group of Idrians walking along the street nearby, one pulling a cart that had probably once held produce. They were easy to distinguish by their muted dress. It surprised her that they would come so far to trade, but admittedly, commerce hadn't been particularly robust in Idris lately. Reluctantly, she closed her eyes and, using the shawl to hide the transformation, changed her hair from gray to brown. If there were other Idrians in town, it was unlikely that she would stand out. Trying to act like an old woman would be more suspicious. It still felt wrong to be exposed. In Vivalis, she'd have been recognized instantly. Of course, Vivalis had only a few thousand people in it. The vastly greater scale of Tetelier would require a conscious adjustment. Havenna gestured to Parlin and, gritting her teeth, joined the crowd and began making her way toward the marketplace. The inland sea made all the difference. Tetelier was a prime port, and the dyes it sold, made from the tears of Igli, a local flower, made it a center of trade. She could see the evidence all around her. Exotic silks and cloven, brown-skinned traders from Tadradl, with their long black beards bound with tight leather cord into cylindrical shapes. Fresh foodstuffs from cities along the coast. In Idris, the population was spread out thinly across the farms and rangelands. In Halandrin, a country which controlled a good third of the inland sea's coast, things were different. They could burgeon, grow, get flamboyant. In the distance, she could see the plateau that held the Court of Gods, the most profane place beneath Austria's colorful eyes. Inside its walls, within the God King's terrible palace, Ciri was being held captive, prisoner of Suzebron himself. Logically, Vivenna understood her father's decision. In raw political terms, Vivenna was more valuable to Idris. If war was certain, it made sense to send a less useful daughter as a stalling tactic. But it was hard for Vivenna to think of Ciri as less useful. She was gregarious, but she'd also been the one who smiled when others were down. She was the one who brought gifts when nobody was expecting them. She was infuriating, but also innocent. She was Vivenna's baby sister, and someone had to look out for her. The God King would demand an heir. That was to have been Vivenna's duty, her sacrifice for her people. She had been prepared and willing. It felt wrong for Ciri to have to do something so terrible. Her father had made his decision, the best one for Idris. Vivenna had made her own. If there was going to be war, then Vivenna wanted to be ready to get her sister out of the city the moment it got dangerous. In fact, Vivenna felt there had to be a way to rescue Ciri before the war came. A way of fooling the Halandrins, making them think that Ciri had died. Something that would save Vivenna's sister, yet not further provoke hostilities. This wasn't something her father could condone, so she hadn't told him. Better for him to be able to deny involvement if things went wrong. Vivenna moved down the street, eyes downcast, careful not to draw attention to herself. Getting away from Idris had been surprisingly easy. Who would suspect such a brash move from Vivenna? She, who had always been perfect. Nobody wondered when she asked for food and supplies, explaining that she wanted to make emergency kits. Nobody questioned when she'd proposed an expedition to the higher reaches to gather important roots, an excuse to disguise the first few weeks of her disappearance. Parlin had been easy enough to persuade. He trusted her, perhaps too much, and he had intimate knowledge of the paths and trails leading down to Halandrin. He'd been as far as the city walls on one scouting trip a year back. With his help, she'd been able to recruit a few of his friends, also woodsmen, to protect her and be part of her expedition. She'd sent the rest of them back earlier that morning. They would be of little use in the city, where she had already arranged for other allies to be her protection. Parlin's friends would carry word to her father, who would already have heard of what she'd done. Before leaving, she'd arrange for her maid to deliver a letter to him about the time when her absence would begin to look suspicious. Counting off the days, she realized that her letter would be delivered that very evening. She didn't know what her father's reaction would be. Perhaps he would send soldiers to retrieve her, though they would have to be covert. Perhaps he'd leave her be. She'd warned him that if she weren't given time to assess whether or not Ciri could be rescued, she would simply go to the Court of Gods, explain that there had been a mistake, and trade herself for her sister. She'd warned that if she saw any hint of Idris' soldiers searching for her in the city, she'd take that step immediately. She sincerely hoped she wouldn't have to. The God King was not to be trusted. He might take Vivenna captive and keep Ciri, thereby providing him with two princesses to provide pleasure instead of one.
Don't think about that.
Better to find another way. Part of Vivenna knew there was a chance she wouldn't be able to find one. Yet she'd had to come, had to do something, at least try. The first step was to find Lennox, her father's chief spy in Halandrin. Vivenna had corresponded with him on several occasions. Her father had wanted her to be familiar with his best intelligence agent in Tetelir, should she need him during her reign as Suzebron's queen. Her father's foresight would work against him. Lennox knew Vivenna and had been told to take orders from her. She'd sent the spy a letter, delivered by a messenger with multiple mounts to allow quick delivery, the day she'd left Idris. Assuming the message had arrived safely, the spy would meet her in the appointed restaurant. Her plan seemed good. She was prepared. Why, then, did she feel so utterly daunted when she entered the market? She stood quietly, a rock in the stream of human traffic flooding down the street. It was such an enormous expanse covered in tents, pens, buildings, and people. There were no cobblestones here, only sand and dirt with the occasional patch of grass, and there didn't appear to be much reason or direction to the arrangement of buildings. The arbitrary streets had simply been made where people felt like going. It was an orgy of color and motion.
Wow!
Weren't you just here?
Yeah. Wow, again.
Let's go to the restaurant.
This way.
Vivenna followed him, annoyed. This was Halandrin. She shouldn't be awed by it. She should be disgusted. Yet she was so overwhelmed that it was hard to feel anything beyond a slight sense of sickness. She'd never realized how much she took Idris' beautiful simplicity for granted. Parlin's familiar presence was welcome as the powerful wave of scents, sounds, and sights tried to drown her. In some places, the crowds grew so thick that they had to shove their way through. On occasion, Vivenna found herself on the edge of panic, pressed in by dirty, repulsively colored bodies. Blessedly, the restaurant wasn't too far in, and they arrived just when she thought the sheer excess of the place would make her scream. On its signboard out front, the restaurant had a picture of a boat sailing merrily. If the scents coming from inside were any indication, then the ship represented the restaurant's cuisine. Fish. Vivenna barely kept herself from gagging. She'd eaten fish several times in preparation for her life in Halandrin. She'd never grown to like it. Parlin walked in, immediately stepping to the side and crouching, almost like a wolf, as he let his eyes adjust to the dimness. The restaurant keeper eyed Parlin, then shrugged, and led Vivenna and Parlin to one of the tables on the far side of the room. Vivenna sat down. Despite her training, she was a little uncertain what one did at a restaurant. It seemed significant to her that places like restaurants should exist in Halandrin, places meant to feed not travelers, but the locals who couldn't be bothered to prepare their own food and dine at their own houses. Parlin didn't sit, but remained standing beside her chair, watching the room.
Vivenna, your hair.
Vivenna realized that her hair had lightened from the trauma of pushing her way through the crowd. It hadn't bleached completely white, she was far too well trained for that, but it had grown whiter, like it had been powdered. Feeling a jolt of paranoia, Vivenna replaced the shawl on her head, looking away as the restaurant owner approached to take their order. A short list of meals was scratched into the table, and Parlin finally sat down, drawing the restaurant owner's attention away from Vivenna.
You're better than this. You've studied Halandrin for most of your life.
Vivenna's hair darkened, returning to its brown. The change was subtle enough that if someone had been watching, they would have probably thought it to be a trick of the light. She kept the shawl up, feeling ashamed. One walk through the market, and she lost control?
Think of Ciri.
That thought gave her strength. Her mission was impromptu, even reckless, but it was important. Calm, once again, she put the shawl back down and waited while Parlin chose a dish.
I will try seafood stew.
The innkeeper nodded and walked away.
Now what?
We wait. In my letter, I told Lennox to check the restaurant each day at noon. We will sit here until he arrives.
Parlin nodded, fidgeting.
What is it?
I don't trust this place, Vivenna. I can't smell anything but bodies and spices. Can't hear anything but the chatter of people. There's no wind, no trees, no river, just people.
I know.
I want to go back outside.
What? Why?
If you aren't familiar with a place, you need to become familiar with it.
Parlin gave no other explanation. Vivenna felt a stab of fear at the thought of being left alone. However, It wasn't proper to demand Parlin stay in the tender.
Do you promise to stay close?
Right.
Then go.
Parlin walked from the room. He didn't move like one of the Halandrans. His motions were too fluid, too much like a prowling beast.
Perhaps I should have sent him back with the others.
But the thought of being completely alone had been too much. She needed someone to help her find Lennox. As it was, she felt that she was probably taking too great a risk at entering the city with only one guard, even one as skilled as Parlin. But it was done. No use worrying now. She sat, arms folded on the table, thinking. Back in Idris, her plan to save Ciri had seemed simpler. Now the true nature of it lay before her. Somehow, she had to get into the Court of Gods and sneak her sister out. How would one accomplish something so audacious? Certainly the Court of Gods would be well guarded.
Lennox will have ideas. We don't have to do anything yet.
A man sat down at her table. Less colorfully dressed than most Halandrans, he wore an outfit made mostly of brown leather, though he did have a token red cloth vest thrown over the top. This was not Lennox. The spy was an older man in his 50s. The man sitting with her had a long face and styled hair and couldn't have been older than 35.
Oh, I hate being a mercenary. You know why?
Shocked, Vivenna sat frozen, mouth opened slightly.
The prejudice. Everyone else, they work, they ask for recompense, and they are respected for it. Not mercenaries. We get a bad name for just doing our job. How many minstrels get spat on for accepting payment from the highest bidder? How many bakers feel guilty for selling more of pastries to one man? Then selling those same pastries to the man's enemies.
The man eyed her.
No, only a mercenary. Unfair, wouldn't you say?
Who are you?
Vivenna jumped as another man sat down on her other side. Large of girth, this man had a cudgel strapped to his back. A colorful bird was sitting on the end of it.
I'm dead.
The first man took Vivenna's hand and shook it.
And that's Tonkfar.
Pleased.
Tonkfar took her hand once Denth was through with it.
Unfortunately, Princess, we're here to kill you.
Vivenna's hair instantly bleached to a stark white.
Think, you've been trained in politics. You've studied hostage negotiation. But what do you do when you are the hostage?
Sorry, Princess. Just a bit of mercenary humor.
We kill sometimes, but we don't murder. That's assassin's work.
Assassins? Now, they get respect. Why do you suppose that is? They're really just mercenaries with fancier names. Institutional bias, I tell you.
You're not here to kill me. So you're just going to kidnap me?
Oh, gods no. Bad business, that. How do you make money at it? Every time you kidnap someone worth the ransom, you upset people a whole lot more powerful than you are.
Don't make important people angry, unless you're getting paid by people who are even more powerful.
And that isn't even considering the feeding and care of captives, the exchanging of ransom notes and the arranging of drop-offs. Oh, it's a headache, I tell you. Terrible way to make money.
They know who I am. Either they recognize me or you work for Lennox.
See, Tonk? He said she was a clever one.
Guess that's why she's a princess and we're just mercenaries.
Are they mocking me or not? Where is Lennox? Why didn't he come himself?
Denth smiled again, nodding toward the restaurant owner as the man brought a large pot of steaming stew to the table. It smelled of hot spices and had what appeared to be crab claws floating in it. The owner dropped a group of wooden spoons to the table, then retreated. Denth and Tonk Fa didn't wait for permission to eat her meal.
Your friend Lennox, our employer, isn't doing so well.
Fevers.
He requested that we bring you to him.
Denth handed her a folded piece of paper with one hand while cracking a claw between three fingers of the other.
Any more fresh and I would have to beat you to death myself.
Please trust these men. Denth has served me well for some measure now. And he is loyal, if any mercenary can be called loyal. He and his men have been paid, and I am confident he will stay true to us for the duration of his contract. I offer proof of authenticity by virtue of this password, Blue Mask.
The writing was in Lemmick's hand. More than that, he had given the proper password, not Blue Mask, that was misdirection. The true password was using the word measure instead of time.
Ah, now, this is a tricky part. She has to make a decision. Are we telling her the truth or are we fooling her? Have we fabricated that letter? Or maybe we took the old spy captive and tortured him, forcing him to write the words.
We could bring you his fingers as proof of our good faith. Would that help?
Mercenary humour.
Such that it is. We're not generally a clever lot. Otherwise, we'd probably have selected a profession without such a high mortality rate.
Like your profession, Princess. Good lifespans, usually. I've often wondered if I should apprentice myself to one.
Lennox wouldn't have broken under torture. He's too well trained. Even if he had broken, he wouldn't have included both the real password and the false one. Let's go.
Wait, we're skipping the rest of our meal?
Vanna eyed the red-colored soup and its bobbing crustacean limbs.
Definitely.